Hello, and welcome to the By Doing Good podcast, where we feature powerful conversations with people working on the front line of social innovation. I'm Scott, the UK lead for Big Bloom and your host for this episode. Our guest today is Francis Suter, CEO of Cure Kids, New Zealand's largest charitable funder of child health research. Cure Kids is committed to finding better treatments and preventative strategies for a wide range of serious child health conditions. From the start of her career as a nurse, through her 25 years in the pharmaceuticals industry, and now at Cure Kids, Frances has pursued her passion for innovations in science that help people live longer and healthier lives. In today's episode, we discuss the life-changing work Cure Kids does, the importance of Francis's business acumen to the resilience, growth and success of the charity, the long-standing relationship between Cure Kids and one of their key corporate partners, the Briscoes Group, and the upcoming Big Bloom Hackathon. So settle in for this inspiring conversation with Francis. So Francis, we're here to learn all about you as the leader of this incredible charity, Cure Kids, working on the front line of social impact. And maybe a great place to begin is just to hear from you as the CEO, the head of the company. What is Cure Kids here to do in the world?
Such a big question. So basically, what if we're getting it right, then every New Zealand child and actually internationally has the best opportunity to live their healthiest life with a really bright future. So the only way that we can really do that is by resolving some of the challenges that children currently have today that stop them from doing exactly that. So Cure Kids was founded 52 years ago now by two incredible paediatricians. I got to know Sir Bob Elliott very well. He was this incredible innovative maverick from Adelaide in Australia who came to New Zealand and could see that the children that were in his care were struggling with the impact of illnesses and conditions that really was quite third world, and the fact that New Zealand child health was performing poorly compared to other OECD countries. And because we have this sort of beautiful, unique population, which includes Māori and Pacific children, that we have unique conditions that you can't just take cookie cutter research from overseas and say, yes, that's going to work for children in New Zealand. So it needs to be quite specific. And in those days, the only research that was really being done on child health in New Zealand was adult researchers doing research in the hope that it will have implications for child health. So the group of people sort of got together and said, let's really try and invest in the research community and the research that's being done in New Zealand specifically for children. And so they established the very first what we call professorial chair, or somebody who takes full responsibility for a program of research specific to children. And interestingly, that was established as the Child Health Research Foundation, funded by Rotary initially. So we've got this beautiful history with Rotary as an organisation as well.
It strikes me as incredible foresight in a way to recognize this challenge and to recognize the fact that international research wouldn't cut it or wasn't even necessarily focused enough on the lives of children in New Zealand. Really, you know, a unique perspective, I guess, that only perhaps a pediatrician or somebody from that background could have understood. I noticed, Francis, from your own background as well, you started out in nursing, is that right?
I did. I think I've always had a passion for health and science and And I guess came from a big family. I'm one of six siblings and middle child, the peacekeeper. just, yeah, what really was very interested in health and well-being, and so took the career direction of doing my nursing training, and really loved that, but could also felt a little bit frustrated with the health system at the time. You know, there was understaffing, and so thought that I would take a little bit of a segue for what I originally anticipated would only be a few months, and joined a pharmaceutical company as a sales rep, and absolutely only intended to do it perhaps for about a year, and then the, you know, 30-year career in the pharmaceutical industry. And loved it because it's still about the science. It's still about, you know, the innovation and the incredible medicines that we have now, which ensure that we do live, you know, longer, healthier lives. But I guess then sort of towards the end of my career, when I had to make, or not the end of my career, but the end of that stint in the pharmaceutical industry, thinking about what are the things that I'm really passionate about, how am I as an individual going to make a difference? And it sort of led me to, I was working in Asia at the time for Pfizer, and I thought, actually, I want to get home. I want to go to New Zealand, see if I can make a difference in New Zealand in the health sector. And serendipitously, the role came up at Cure Kids, and I thought, okay, this is telling me something here, and was successful in getting the role. And so I sort of feel like I've moved from being the fence at the bottom of the cliff through pharmaceuticals to now the ambulance at the top, which is, or the fence at the top of the cliff instead of the ambulance at the bottom. So yeah, and obviously it's the whole spectrum of child health, whether it's, you know, prevention of disease through immunization, right through to finding out what causes diseases, right through to treatments and better outcomes. So it's the whole sort of spectrum of health, which I love.
It's and I'm really struck by the fact that, you know, your kind of reflection on what your purpose is and how you want to kind of spend this part of your life and your career, like giving back and having a positive impact, is really the story of the founders of the organization as well, right? You know, it's the same story.
It is, yeah, making that small difference over time, so that, you know, we've got a generation of children whose health we may not improve now, but we hopefully will have a big enough impact that their children and their grandchildren will have better opportunities for a healthy life.
I'm struck by that as well, because certainly in the nonprofit space as well, a lot of the problems are wicked problems. They're slightly intractable almost. And the passion and the dedication required to set your attention and your energy towards challenges that you may never see the solution to as well. You know, we talk about this in the social impact and the environmental impact spaces, cathedral building. And a lot of the people who built the early cathedrals would never have seen the finished article, because they took generations to build. So thinking a little bit about the future then, you know, usually we come to these sorts of questions later in the podcast, but we're here right now, right? Thinking a little bit about the future, what do you envisage, you know, the legacy of the work that you're doing with Cure Kids will be, Frances?
So, you know, to pull out one example, I'd love to see a future where no child contracts rheumatic fever and ends up with rheumatic heart disease. I mean, these are third world illnesses, which, you know, are still incredibly predominant in populations in New Zealand. At the moment, 40,000 children are admitted to hospital every year with completely preventable illnesses. So that might be a respiratory infection or a skin infection, which could so easily be treated in primary care. And so I would love to be able to see that children are only presenting at hospital for things that are, you know, that aren't preventable. So, yeah, we've got some pretty dire statistics that I'd love to see wound back, and that every child has the equivalent access to primary care, and that we don't see kids having to go to hospital to have teeth extracted because they've been left so long that they're now forming abscesses. So, yeah, just making sure that that a child is admitted hospital because of a worst case scenario rather than just not having access to, not having access to primary care. And I think the long-term impact of that is that we won't end up with adults with, chronic illnesses that weren't, may not have been addressed in childhood. So, we know that early childhood respiratory disease causes, chronic obstructive airway disease later in life. So, so it's there's a long game. It's a long game, but there's a long game.
I love that. I love that. And I'm really struck as well. I think that there are certain kind of diseases, certainly conditions that get a lot of coverage. We might talk about cancers or other kind of high profile, if you want to call it that, childhood diseases. But hearing you talk about dental care, for example, and I noticed also on the website, that currently with active projects, mental health and well-being, there's 11 active projects. Tell me a little bit more about the kind of the breadth of different research that's funded by Cure Kids.
Yeah, so it's really one of the things I'm the most proud of is we have a collaboration with the Child Cancer Foundation. So two charities working together funding this amazing paediatrician called and Dr. Andy Wood. And he's looking at the genetics behind certain rare cancers in children. And by genetically testing these kids, we can get targeted, very precise treatments to these children, which tends to be is readily available overseas, the sort of targeted what we call precision pediatric cancer treatments. But in New Zealand, blood tests would have to be sent overseas, so it was really expensive. So to be able to allow Andy Wood to do that sort of research here in New Zealand is so powerful. So, and we've got this beautiful little poster child who was diagnosed with this terribly rare cancer, and she's 13 now and doing cartwheels, to fundraise for Red Nose Day, just amazing stories. So so you're right, it's things like dental disease, but then we've also got these very rare entrenched cancers.
It's
There's
a real
another.
breadth of conditions actually being funded here, not just like big ticket items or the most.
No,
How do you
that's
make
right.
how do you define or determine what
What kind of
gets
fund?
what gets funded?
So there's a number of mechanisms, but every year we have a what we call a granting round where it's like an RFP. We put it out to our researchers to say, bring us your most innovative, impactful research projects that are going to make a difference to child health. And the need is definitely growing because even last year we had 49 different projects that we had to review for funding. And we've got an amazing committee called the Medical Scientific Advisory Committee, and they're pediatric experts in across the broad spectrum of research, and they would scrutinize the projects and shortlist basically which ones they think have a robust hypothesis, sort of scientifically sound, and really interestingly and unique to New Zealand conditions, and then the potential impact that they will have on child health. And so it gets whittled down to the point where we'll end up with funding sort of six to nine projects at that year. But doesn't mean that the other sort of 43 weren't any good. It's just that often comes down to an affordability perspective for us to fund, but then also where we think we're going to get the biggest bang for our buck in terms of impact on child health.
I would imagine that receiving funding from Cure Kids is also kind of a career-changing opportunity for some of these academics too, who are kind of, really wishing to go deeper in certain areas. And without Cure Kids, maybe this funding just wouldn't exist.
Definitely. And the interesting thing is, in tandem to that annual granting round, we also fund four professorial chairs. So a little bit like the one that was first established. And they've got their own unique programs of research. So we've got Professor Stephen Robertson in Dunedin, who works on genetics and, and the impact of genetics on child health. And he's got a whole team, so that he's one example of one of our professorial chairs who have a whole team of PhD students and fellows that work within his team. So with being able to fund his work, you have that downstream knock-on effect of adding more investment in the sector so that then they can build a talent pipeline of incredible researchers too. So we've got the four professorial chairs. So genetics in Dunedin, we've got Andrew Day, who's a gastroenterologist in Christchurch. We've got Stuart Dalziel, who is in Auckland, and he's incredible. He's a paediatrician in accident and emergency, so he's really on the cutting edge of where kids get sick. And then we've last year or 2 years ago, we employed an amazing woman, Terri-Ann Clark, whose specific area is adolescent mental health. So when you look at that, the spectrum of research is, from mental health right through to physical health, right through to disorders that are rare and genetic. Sometimes we also get approached by specific philanthropists who are passionate about a particular area of health. So last year we were given a grant to support research in type 1 diabetes. So some of it can be donor-driven research as well.
And actually, this opens up really, really interesting areas. Like, where does the money for the research come from? Obviously, some philanthropic donors. I noticed there's like fundraising opportunities. And tell me a little bit about how you keep the lights on at Cure Kids and fund all this incredible
Sure.
research.
Well, I'm quite grateful because we have got a diversified stream of funding, and that really helped us through COVID because there were so many things that just shut down. You couldn't have street appeals or so. I'm really grateful for the fact that we've got this diversified area of funding. So one a really good example and the essence for this project is we've got this beautiful partnership with the Briscoes Group. And as an organisation, they have said, we love Cure Kids, we love what they do. We will, we will effectively campaign for Cure Kids. So when you go into Briscoes or Rebel Sport to buy your toaster or your new pair of sports shoes, they've trained all of their staff to say, would you like to make a donation to Cure Kids? So they're just an incredible organization who, right from the top, Rod Duke, who's the CEO, has been a beautiful philanthropist, and that he actually supported one of our professorial chairs personally. And then right down to the young guys at the checkout who will make the ask when you buy your appliance, so or whatever it is you buy at Briscoe. So that's a perfect example of an incredible partnership which is threaded right through the tapestry of that organisation.
It's pretty special to have a partner who's so invested, right? And for the long term as well.
Yeah, totally. So then we'll have organisations who will take it more from a team building perspective, and will organise events that fundraise for Cure Kids, or individuals who will participate in our fundraising events. Every year we have an annual gala dinner, which is probably one of our biggest fundraisers. And a lot of the proceeds that come from our gala dinner feed the annual granting round. Just everyday, well, everyday heroes who just are happy to donate regularly to Cure Kids. And you know, specific fundraisers that we do, or philanthropists who've decided that they want to back a specific research project. We've got a steady, loyal stream of people who give to us regularly. And then we're always in the hope that somebody will think of Cure Kids in their will and leave a bequest as well. So there's Red Nose is our biggest campaign, which we run through July, which is sort of our most visible fundraising campaign.
And I wondered too, and I was curious whether the pharmaceutical industry has a stake in the work that Cure Kids is doing as well. And you know, given your background and your history working in pharmaceuticals, whether there were any positive relationships between the pharmaceuticals industry and the research that goes on, because obviously the pharma industry is generally quite well funded. And so, yeah, I was just curious if there's any relationship there.
Not really, unfortunately, Scott, but mainly because the pharmaceutical industry in New Zealand is a lot smaller than what it was when I was in the industry. So making those sort of meaningful connections, other than through any research that might be done on specific medications. So we're very much at arm's length with that. The relationship would be between the researcher and the organisation that the research is about. I think the industry, pharmaceutical industry, sadly in New Zealand, is quite lean, and most of the resourcing is either out of Australia or out of Asia. So, but having said that, you know, we've still got some strong supporters in the industry who, so Douglas Pharmaceuticals is a great example of a local industry that supports not-for-profit hugely. So there's still those sort of more family-based pharmaceutical industries that are local to New Zealand and can appreciate the local charities.
Interesting. I'm really curious to come back to the Briscoes Group and the upcoming hackathon as well, and just not wanting to give too much away about what's going to be happening during the hackathon, but what are your thoughts about the hackathon? Are you excited? Do you have any expectations about what's to come?
I think the thing, Scott, that I'm going to love about it is, just from a partnership perspective, is what are some of the things that where they've got quite a different lens, and what are some of the creative, ambitious ideas that they can come up with that we don't think about because we're so embedded in what we do. And I think it's just opening our eyes a little bit more to what a key partner sees as a good opportunity for us, and knowing how embedded they are, but they've also got their own organisation to run. And it's the Briscoes Group is a hugely successful organisation, and so, you know, humbly, I would love to see that, you know, that what the talent at Briscoes can imagine for us as an organisation.
Nothing like an external set of eyes to look at the challenge that you're facing as well. And I know often when we talk to nonprofits, they can be experts in the problem, and very much focused around, you know, the day to day. And it can be difficult in any kind of an organization to find time and space to zoom out and to see things from a different perspective. And I think, you know, the hackathon often does give that potential.
One of the most valuable things I did when I came into Cure Kids as CEO was I went out, we lost a couple of really key corporate partners. And it was so valuable for me to go out and talk to some of those partners to say, what did we do well and where did we go wrong? And that was so interesting, you know, and I think we were almost apologetic in our relationships with some of our corporate partners. And, you know, I sort of likened it to the, you know, Oliver, please, sir, can we have some more? Instead of getting that strength of conviction of what we do and how the important part that we play in the health of New Zealanders, and feeling proud about what we do and instilling that pride in our partners. And we certainly see that with Briscoe's. It doesn't feel like, it feels like a very equal footing in a marriage of, you know, of hearts, really. All, you know, we believe in the same things. And I think that's key to those sort of crucial corporate partnerships.
Yeah, and listen, I've no doubt as well, with a partner who's already so kind of embedded in the work that you do, what an opportunity for the participants in the hackathon too, to really kind of roll up their sleeves and feel like they're actively contributing to the work that Cure Kids does, right? In an even more direct way, perhaps, than the everyday work that they're doing across the network.
Absolutely. It's a, yeah, really, we, you know, we, it's an amazing opportunity for us.
Yeah, I hope it'll be lots of fun too. They usually are. You mentioned there, you know, one of the things that you did when you first came in as CEO. I think you've been CEO for probably nearly 9 years, maybe 8.5 years, something like that. What kind of company did you join, you know, 8.5 years ago? How different was Cure Kids back then?
Completely different, Scott. So there was a huge focus on events which it really needed somebody to just come in and say, is this still relevant now? You know, and I hark back to, Cure Kids used to have this incredible event called the Great Adventure Race, which in its heyday, corporates would put teams in, they'd fundraise $10,000 per team, and there might be 45 teams in the event. So, you know, easily the event would raise $500,000. But a massive event to organise and lots of staff required. And what wasn't considered at the time, and I guess that I came in with the strength of having a commercial background, what wasn't considered was A, the opportunity cost of organising these events, but B, actually the number of salaries that were required to run them. And so it was just taking quite a different lens and saying, when it all comes out of the wash, are we still fun, or in all seriousness to consider, is this a marketing event where we might not actually fundraise a lot, but actually it's giving us a good profile? So the issue was, a lot of the events that we'd run had sort of run out of steam, as things do, the novelty wears off. And so we're in the heyday, they would have raised sort of $450,000. And the last one that we did raised $160,000. So, you know, and when you looked at all the costs, you know, so I think what I brought to the organisation was a more of a bang for your buck type mentality. And then with, you know, and then looking at what do we need to take this organisation into the future, and being very specific about, you know, the roles that we needed moving forward. And to be honest, Scott, that actually saved us a lot of grief through lockdown, because we had cut out a lot of those big expensive events. And so we'd become a bit more expert at nurturing corporate partnerships and corporate relationships. And that was much more sustainable for us through, you know, through those years where we couldn't actually have that sort of face-to-face or activity-based fundraising.
And it's a fantastic example of the challenge that many nonprofits face, who have become very reliant on, you know, single source grants, or, you know, even a business model that maybe doesn't have a diversified, you know, diversified revenue stream. So, you know, obviously for Cure Kids, this was a really, really valuable thing to do. But I think more generally across all nonprofits, finding, you know, more resilient business models that aren't, you know, singularly dependent on particular types of events or particular type sources of funding is necessary, because unfortunately, you know, things change and the landscape is ever evolving. And I'm sure your commercial background really, like, you know that, right, from from your experience in much more commercial markets?
Yeah, and I think the board were, you know, I was probably one of the first commercial CEOs in the not-for-profit sector, and I think the board were quite strategic in their thinking about putting somebody in who could come at it from a different lens. But then I've got a unique background, and that I've got this sort of, you know, big-hearted humanitarian approach to, despite having been worked for the dark side for so many years, you know, just it was still that sort of humanitarian side was still in there.
And I guess you know, maybe a more pointed question in a way. Did the board were they entirely happy with what they got, or did they feel quite challenged? Because I imagine you brought a different kind of rigor and a different kind of challenge into the organization. What was that like? You know, to what extent did you have to kind of reshape the organization to bring it forward into this kind of mindset? And you know, and did you have the people following you initially?
I think that the team itself, I think, really struggled with this woman who was coming in and talking about money. And I think that, you know, I'll be honest, I think there were, you know, there was it, that we definitely created a culture shift for the better. But the board were 100% behind me. It was actually, and it was quite a liberating growth experience for me as well, because I was used to being caught up in a big corporate culture where, you know, you had to apply to New York if you wanted to have an office move, you know, whereas I went to the board, was able to say things like, okay, where we are, it doesn't work for us anymore, we're paying too much rent, I think we should move here. And they said, go for it, Francis. So it was, so I was very empowered, which, you know, and then, you know, I guess the proof in the pudding is how successful we were. And, you know, and I managed to cut a lot of unnecessary expenses out of Cure Kids. And, you know, what I say to the team all the time is, you've got to go to bed at night of understanding that your salary has been paid for by donation. And if you can put your head on your pillow at night and feel comfortable about what you've given that donor back, then you know you're doing a great job. And I think that's the lens that I came into with Cure Kids, is really making sure that every dollar that was donated was going to go as long way as possible.
Brilliant. Tell me a bit more about your team, Francis. You know, how do you run Cure Kids? How large is the team? What sort of centres is most of the work happening from? What does a day in the life of Cure Kids look like?
So it's interesting. It's taken a long journey and a lot of trial and error. But I think I've got the most amazing team I've had in the 9 years, or nearly 9 years, that I've been there. We've got some really strong, passionate people who are incredibly happy to roll their sleeves up. As I said, it's the smallest that it's been since I started. When I joined, there were 28 team members, and now there's 18. And I think everybody has a very deep understanding of what the other's roles are, and actually is very supportive of each other. Like any organisation, we've got our sort of different departments who have different strengths. So we've got two people who are incredibly smart, who sort of manage the research granting process. So they're the incredibly smart people. We've got an amazing marketing department who are incredibly passionate about our brand and how it's represented. And then we've got effectively the sales team, who are kind of the big personalities who go out and look after and support some of our corporate partners. So, and you know, you know when they're in the office, you know, these beautiful, big, loud personalities. And then we've got our platform functions, who we just couldn't survive without. So incredible office manager and finance manager. And it all works. It's like, you know, I mentioned at the beginning, I'm one of six siblings, and we've all got different personalities, but we're all part of the same family and very united. And I think finally we've got that rub where everybody fully appreciates what they do and supports each other. So it's a really lovely vibe.
Mm. It sounds also like, it's running very lean and very effectively at the moment as well.
Yeah, and I think the beauty with that is that then there's no sort of, oh, that's not my job. It's like, when we have our red nose campaign, it's all hands to the pump. Nothing's beneath anybody, and that I think that being a bit leaner, you're a lot more visible when you're a small organization. So it's very clear if somebody's not pulling their weight.
Yeah, and I think it's, it's as you said, it's a motivating factor for the staff as well to really know that, they're there in service of this incredible research, and their salaries are, donation funded. So, everyone there is really waking up and saying, right, I'm gonna add value. I'm not gonna hide. I'm not gonna wait for somebody else to do the work. I'm gonna step up and really add that value.
Totally.
Amazing, amazing. Well, thinking a little bit about what's to come, okay, you've been there nearly 9 years, Francis. What hope do you have for the future? What's on the horizon that's really exciting that you might want to share?
So I think we're at a really, I mentioned before about rheumatic fever and rheumatic heart disease. And, I think we're really doing some incredible research in that area, which will have incremental impact around the world as well. So that's a, for me, that's a real passion project. But the other thing is that we're really putting a lot more focus on material impact that our research can have. So and how and then really doing a bit of a dive into how do we measure that. And one of the projects that I love talking about is that we had a 25-year program of research looking at cot death, or what's now called sudden unexpected death in infancy. And we had this incredible organization come in and look at it and really measure the social impact of that program of research. And they were able to calculate that for every dollar that was invested in that 25-year program of research, that it had $14 worth of social impact. So I'm really looking forward to, and that didn't take into consideration the cost of a baby's life or the generational grief that occurs from a baby dying. So I'm really looking forward to putting more effort into looking at some of the programs of research that we've done over the years and really delivering messages around this is the measurable impact of what New Zealand has been contributing to and the difference that it'll make. So it's really defining success in our projects. I'm really excited about that. And I think looking for a new and innovative ways and being ahead of the game in terms of fundraising and getting New Zealanders to look more long term about the impact of their donations as well, rather than just, putting shoes on feet. It's actually we can do a lot in terms of prevention of childhood illnesses by through research.
It's beautiful to hear about, Francis. It's really, really lovely to hear. A last question we sometimes ask, so I'll share it with you. The podcast is called By Doing Good, and I wondered for you personally, Francis, as well, what does it mean to do good?
I think it's leaving a footprint, so making a difference that you can say, I've left a mark, and even if there's one child out there who the result of some research that we've funded and it's made a difference to their life, then we would have made a difference. And yeah, so and it's just that it's not about shareholder value, it's about what's the difference that I'm making to some that we as a team are making to children's lives in New Zealand, but also the impact that that has around the world as well.
It sounds incredible and definitely worthwhile. Francis, thank you so much for sharing your time today. It's been really fantastic to hear about your career and also about the incredible work that Cure Kids is doing.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Scott. Lovely to meet you.
If listening to this episode has piqued your interest and you want to find out more about Big Bloom or participate in any of the hackathons organised by them, head to www.bigbloom.org. We always welcome anyone looking to get involved in social innovation. And if you've enjoyed the episode and want to make sure you tune in for more interviews with inspiring social entrepreneurs, please subscribe to the podcast and consider giving us a shiny 5-star review.